From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jackie Leiden has worked with NPR for years, so she knows fashion is a tough sell for the public radio crowd. She's seen the studies, and if you ask people like you, if you're interested in fashion, 95% say no. It's because you think of fashion as trivial and exclusive and wasteful. Leiden says that kind of a response makes sense. If you think about how fashion is covered today, it's connected to celebrity culture and pop trends. But if you changed the focus or the language, you might think differently, because Leiden says fashion is also about memory and identity. It's about culture. Today in the program, we're talking about fashion with Jackie Leiden and with the fashion observer Simon Doonan. We're also hoping to hear from you after this news. This week on Video West, we continue our series of street-style portraits. See the stylish people at Library Square this time, where one elegant fellow told us to give thought to what you love and invest in it. Also in our favorite section, you can see a little film that follows Weekend Edition and New York Times puzzle master Will Shortz play table tennis every day for a year. He's kind of obsessed. Go to VideoWest at KUER.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of the questions we came up with as we were putting the show together is this one. Can you exempt yourself from fashion? Both of our guests today think you can, by the way, if what you mean by that is that you don't put too much thought into the clothing you wear. It's just something you want to simplify in your life, for example. But in another sense, you can't really escape fashion. And not just because styles and trends are pervasive or that designs always tend to filter into the even most ordinary clothing. It's because fashion is culture. That's how journalist Jackie Leiden puts it. Jackie has started a project called The Seams, and she's looking at fashion not just as a style or a trend, though of course that's part of it, but also fashion as identity or as a memory. Fashion is something we use to connect ourselves to others or to transform ourselves. Jackie Leiden is joining us today along with the fashion observer and writer and really fashion icon Simon Doonan. Jackie Leiden has been an NPR host and correspondent for some 35 years now. I mentioned her project called The Seams, an occasional series on NPR, and soon an independent podcast. And she's joining us today from the studios of NPR in Washington. Jackie Leiden, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Well, Doug Fabrizio, thank you so much for having me on this hour on Radio West, and to be on with Simon Doonan. What a thrill and honor.
Yeah, it is. Good. It's a thrill for us, too. Let me introduce Simon, fashion observer, blogger for Slate.com, the creative ambassador for the luxury department store chain Barney's, New York. He's written numerous books. His newest is called The Asylum, True Tales of Madness from a Life in Fashion. And Simon is joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Simon Doonan, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, I guess I want to begin, Jackie, with you, with your personal connection to the subject. Seems as though your mother had an influence on your ideas about fashion. Several years ago, you wrote a memoir about your mother. And she is this flamboyant and eccentric person, also a troubled soul, which you write about in the book. But she was a department store model for a time. So she thought about fashion, probably still does if I get that right.
She does. She does indeed. And she is my icon. Thank you for bringing her up. I wrote a memoir about her called Daughter of the Queen of Sheba, right, which had a lot to do with her bipolar mental illness, which has been a feature of our lives together from almost the get-go. But one of the things that, as I went through the process of writing it, that I realized was my mother had always been a woman of great style as well as substance. She had been a department store model, as you said. She had made all her own clothes. She taught all of her children to sew, her three daughters to sew. And this is someone who came alive in front of the mirror in her imagination, and we would dress, and we would have style shows, and we would invent ourselves. And that, for me, that sort of key component of self-invention and creation was then and is now one of the reasons to do this series and to think about fashion seriously.
Hmm. we don't have to get too much into the memoir right now, but I mean, there was a part of you, I wonder anyway, because of your mother's what seemed like kind of exhausting eccentricities, was there a part of you that wanted to run as far away from, you know, flamboyance and costumes as possible? What did you want?
Not that part.
No, that was the good part.
It still is. We just we put her in Florida each winter for as long as we can afford. Never long enough for her.
Right.
And I have a brilliant picture of her. She's a lively octogenarian now, gorgeous. And she's got on a lavender cashmere wrap that my sister bought her and a $3 Silver Lame Carnaby Street style hat, which she bought herself. So I think that answers your question.
Yeah. What did that mean for your sense of style? I mean, how did it trickle down into the way you think of style, that relationship with your mother?
Presentation. My mother would always say, always think of yourself as the most beautiful woman in the room. And I think that what she meant by that is that beauty comes from inside and that you, whatever it is you're wearing, have at least thought about it and are going to present it. You're going to flaunt it. You're going to be proud of yourself. You're going to stand up straight. And you're going to enter the room. And I liked that then, and I like that now. It probably has a distinct connection to being a radio host. I have to say, Doug, for decades, I enjoyed that I could get dressed here at NPR, and nobody would see how I looked other than my colleagues.
Right.
And I used to say I could wear a clown outfit if I want to, and I'm sure my colleagues sometimes thought I was, because I'm a huge vintage addict, and I'd be a huge high fashion addict if I could afford it, I know. But it doesn't really matter mixing high and low, and I think people like Simon have made that, you know, so possible and accessible. And what it did make me think was about the antecedents of culture. And I'm, of course, a former Middle East correspondent, traveled extensively, and fabric, textile, clothing. This is one way I could connect with people wherever I went, from Afghanistan to North Africa.
Simon Doonan, I want to ask about your experience. I mean, you grew up in Reading, outside of London. That was a pretty blue-collar in those days, if I understand that right. Did you have a fashion icon in the early days?
Well, I think I had quite a similar experience to Jackie. You know, my mom, who was born in rural Northern Ireland and who left school at 13, she was a style advocate as well. And through watching my mom, as she would say, getting tarted up, you know, I need to go get tarted up, I would see the transformative power of fashion, you know, because my mum didn't look like any of the other ladies in the street. She looked more sort of like Lana Turner or Betty Davis, kind of, because she was very 1940s in her style. So for her, it was very important. It was sort of life-affirming. And through her, I saw that style, fashion, you know, think about people when they're very depressed. The first thing to go is their appearance. So with Jackie's mother, I suspect, and my mom, the style was like some kind of attempt to keep depression at bay, to keep anxiety under control, because you always felt good if you pulled your look together. And it was, so in that way, style and vanity are life-affirming, and they're an antidepressant. So I think there's so many reasons why one might become addicted to it, especially if you have psychological turmoil, as obviously Jackie's mom did.
Mm-hmm. The term "the asylum" in your new book, it has a double meaning for you. On one hand, it's that, you know, kind of mad, crazy world of fashion, which you write about, but asylum also for you, in the sense that it was a refuge as well.
Well, yes, keeping in mind that my book is essentially a humor book, but there is this there's this hypothesis underpinning it, which is that fashion is simultaneously a madhouse, as you say, but also a refuge for people like me who are essentially unemployable, you know, crazy, unemployable gypsies from hither and thither who find a home, a refuge in fashion. I don't know if that's still true today, but it was very much true for my generation. All the quirky, freaky, unconventional people could find a foothold in the world of fashion. And when I read The Devil Wears Prada, I thought, I don't recognize any of these people because my world of fashion, my realm of fashion, was always sort of misfits, oddballs, super creative people, you know, like the Alexander McQueens of the world, and people from not necessarily advantageous backgrounds, who found a place where they were welcomed, where all their faults suddenly became magnificent attributes.
Mm. How would you describe Jackie Leiden, the way fashion it generally is covered, because there is this resistance that a lot of us feel for fashion in the sense that it's trivial or wasteful. But you've talked about how that's often the way it's fashion has been covered. Would you talk about that?
Well, I think there's two things I would say about that. First of all, we are talking about, and the things I want to say are a little in opposition to one another. We are talking about an industry that, whether you measure it by industry standards of $300 billion a year or something like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Americans spending about $200 billion a year on fashion, we are talking about a huge global industry which provides millions of jobs, 1.5 million in retail right here in the United States. There is absolutely nothing trivial about an economic powerhouse like that. If you are talking about the language of some magazines, then you might indeed think about superficiality, as in who wore it best or that kind of thing. I thought those things are fun. I mean, I grab those things when I'm getting my nails done just like anybody else. But even though many fashion journalists are some of the hardest working journalists out there, I'm talking about people who file 3, 4, 5 times a day during these fashion weeks and do it in some of our great newspapers and blogs with, you know, fantastic prose. I was watching a woman last night blog from the French ambassador's house as the great Pulitzer Prize-winning critic Robin Givhan was being feted for her new book, Battle of Versailles. I'm just thinking, oh, my goodness, they're working as hard as I ever did, you know, on Middle East deadlines. But I think that there is also, and this is the part in opposition where fashion has to answer, and I have talked with people who write about it who say this, there is a certain amount of inanity, there is a certain amount of exclusivity, and there is a certain amount of sneer, I think, which allows some people to think that fashion is not for them and they should run as fast as possible away from the word. In fact, we started using the word clothing to talk more about what we do because we see the commentary at some of our pieces. And I don't want that for fashion. I think clothes are too creative, and people like Simon Doonan and his peers have contributed too much art to this world for us to feel dismissive about it.
This is something you've written about, you've talked about too, the idea that I think this was one of the things that you responded to that you didn't like about The Devil Wears Prada, that it was these people who were just sort of corporate climbers, when the people you knew in the fashion world were, as Jackie mentioned, you know, obviously eccentric and passionate, but they were incredibly, you know, creative.
But now the fashion landscape is so vast, as Jackie pointed out. It's almost infinite, you know. So you've got this vast fashion landscape, which is a juggernaut financially, but it's also a vast landscape of ideas and approaches. So you have, on this huge landscape, you have some people who are very much only think about fashion as the couture of Paris and Italy and whatever, and as still have this vision of the word fashion as addressing this small, very incestuous activity. And then you have people that see fashion purely in terms of celebrity. You know, they think fashion is red carpet gowns. You know, I certainly don't subscribe to that idea. But a lot of people, probably the majority of people, if you said the word fashion, that's what would come to mind. So now I think the key is, now it's such a vast landscape. It's a global industry, but it's also a global spectator sport. And You almost have to just surrender to it. It's really hard to make sense of it. And I think I've done something that sounds like Jackie's done too, which is you can sort of differentiate between clothes and fashion. You know, you might run into Uniqlo and get some clothes because you're cold, you know, and you need to get some great basics. But then you go up to Barney's because they have the new Givenchy, whatever, some very sort of esoteric garment that's had an enormous amount of thought put into it. So probably, you know, if you wanted to define fashion, you'd have to look at it that way as clothes and fashion. But it's all nonverbal communication. And for me, it's all sort of a wacky anthropology. You know, I kind of like everything. And when I get on those shows like Fashion Police, I'm terrible on those because I don't have the disdain thing that you were talking about where people sneer and they're disdainful. I kind of love everything. I was once... Am I talking too much?
No.
I was once auditioning for that show, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, right. And they showed me a picture of some dude in wearing a Metallica T-shirt with a mullet. And I said, he looks great. Because my thing is, I think there's room for everything on this vast, chaotic landscape.
But Jackie, do you think Simon's an exception? I mean, certainly you see things like Fashion Police, for example, which is based on. I know it's whimsical for sure, but I wonder if you think Simon, who is accepting of all the wonderful differences, if there are others who are more inclined, you know, for the rules and judgment.
You know, Simon won't remember this, but when I was a wee tot of a radio girl, I actually called him in New York when he was still dressing the windows, these fabulous Christmas windows at Barney's, and asked him about those windows and pretended that I had been to New York to see them, which I had not. So what I want to say that's relevant about that is this is where imagination comes in, and this is where he is opening a door where we are looking into things. And Fashion Police is about... I think, you know, not to get too Greek on you here, but it's a sort of about blinding somebody's vision, right? It's about your vision's wrong and mine is right. And I think that I, too, you know, the seams, our motto, clothing is our common thread in every stitch a story. One of the things we want to look at is anthropology. We want to look at history. We were just at the Bard Graduate Center, a townhouse gallery in New York, looking at undergarments from the 16th century up till today. I want to look at what people are saying. And when you have the word police in there, you stop free speech about fashion, you know, and then it becomes a whole lot less fun and interesting.
Simon, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I was just thinking, I spend so much of my waking life telling women, don't be self-critical. You know, fashion today is about having your look. It's about self-expression in the most intrinsic, meaningful way. You must express yourself. And it's not a race. It's not a contest. You know, and I always tell them the story of one time when I had to leave my apartment dressed as Queen Elizabeth II. And yes, I did. It's too long a story to explain why. But it was in the middle of the afternoon. And my doorman, I thought, I'm never going to live this down. But my doorman just looked at me, and it was a full regalia. It was sort of like the state dinner outfit with everything. Right. And he said, do you want your mail now or when you come back? And so I always tell women that story. I said, which the takeaway from that story is that you are absolutely free. All this time you spend being overly self-critical, which I feel is a feminine trait which men are now catching up to. I spend all this time inveighing against it. And then they'll say, so who do you think looked better? Blah, 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 blah. So there's a very ingrained thing in people to want to thumbs up or thumbs down at any given moment. I don't have that, but I often feel like a lone voice.
I'll have to help you reinforce it, Simon.
This would be a decent segue for you, because I was interested in the section where you write about Hardy Amos, who, of course, I don't know if he's, he dressed the Queen in those wonderful... well, he dressed her in a way that you write about, Simon Doonan, that he had this critique of something that would be too chic as being unkind. Do you have a moment to tell that story?
Yes, absolutely. Hardy Amis is very well known in England. He was Sir Hardy Amis, dressed the Queen Mother and the Queen, and is credited with creating that sort of iconic look where she's wearing the matching hat, coat, and she sort of basically looks like a very nice oven mitt, you know, but and I say that with an immense amount of love. So I, being young and sort of cheeky at the time, said to Sir Hardy Amis, "So tell me, how did you come up with the Queen's iconic look?" And he could tell where I was going with it, you know, that I was essentially saying, you know, that I was treating it with affectionate humor. And he said, "Young man, you must understand that the Queen can never look chic. The Queen must never, ever look chic. She must always look kind and approachable. And the reason for that is simple. There is an unkindness to chic." And that's really stuck with me. And it's so absolutely true. Anyone in a public servant like the Queen, you have to look approachable. And if you want to look chic, you could never get voted into public office, you know, looking like hardcore Daphne Guinness, you know, Tilda Swinton, right off the runway chic. Any woman who looks like she's spending too much time preening and obsessing about her appearance to the point of view of being a fashion icon would be like Marie Antoinette. We all know what happened to her.
Mm. Although Julia Dreyfus does pretty well in Veep.
Well, she looks very appropriate, I think, and stylish, but she's not sort of wearing the latest runway exits, you know?
No,
so, Jackie, are you hoping to change that, you know, change the mass sense of the idea that someone can be chic and still be, you know, electable?
Sure. I'll just wave my magic wand and pull the rug out from underneath the culture. But that's a great question because I want to know what you're wearing and why you're interested. I hope we can get to that in just a few moments. I think that I do want people to be assertive about what they've chosen to put on their bodies. This is our second skin. And I have heard a lot from "I don't care." I'm to the point where that's fine, you know, but we're reading you anyway. And men can get away with that more than women can. So there's an inequity to a statement like that. We recently had in the commentary, the remark, "Well, all you need is a pair of chinos and a Pendleton," and you know that may be true for the individual involved and look fabulous in that context. But we're reading things, and I think that it would be great if a female candidate or a male candidate could be a little more sartorially definitive, transformative, and find that was an accepted statement.
Well, I think it
just
is,
as, you know?
Yeah.
Please.
I think we have that at the moment with Mrs. Obama. She's always exquisitely dressed, beautifully put together. She steers a really beautiful course with not looking too insanely high fashion. That wouldn't work for her. Mm-hmm. She always looks exquisitely appropriate and beautifully dressed. So, I mean, there's room for that. And you had that with Jackie Kennedy as well. And I think Mrs. Mm-hmm. Obama's raised the bar, actually. She's always wearing something interesting and glamorous. But I think she manages to always look beautifully stylish without looking like she spends all day thinking about it. You know, she manages to look like a competent, serious double law graduate, which is what she is, you know.
Right.
It's Jackie Leiden, longtime correspondent for NPR and the creator of The Seams. It's a podcast and a radio series for NPR. Simon Doonan is the creative ambassador for the department store chain Barney's New York. His latest book is called The Asylum, True Tales of Madness from a Life in Fashion. At Video West, we've started a series where we investigate style on the streets of Salt Lake City and other places in Utah. It's called Street Style. Go to videowest.kuer.org, where we've just posted a new video on the site. We filmed this one at downtown Salt Lake City's Library Square. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Strike the pose. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about fashion. A lot of us, when we hear the term fashion, think frivolous and trivial, but longtime NPR correspondent Jackie Leiden sees history and sociology. Simon Doonan also sees anthropology in the word. Jackie Leiden leads a podcast and a radio project called The Seams. Simon Doonan is a fashion observer, writer, and blogger. Let's take a call from Bob, who's with us in Salt Lake. Bob, welcome.
Hi, Doug. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Good.
Really interesting subject. I'm a 68-year-old guy, straight guy. I consider myself an artist in a few different ways, but I'll stay on subject. Ever since I was 12, I was interested in clothes and have come to sort of see my body as the canvas and my clothing selections as an expression of one of my art forms. So I just want to throw that comment out, and I'm really enjoying the conversation, and I'll take it off the air.
Good, thanks. Simon or Jackie, you want to respond to that?
Well, I
love to hear a guy calling and saying that he's using his appearance for such a sort of life-enhancing kind of self-expression. That's pretty groovy, right, Jackie?
It's so groovy, Austin. No, it's just that we are doing a story, I believe it'll be on Saturday morning, weekend edition, with Scott Simon, about the photographer, I.K. Uday. And he's, I'm sure Simon is familiar with him. He's a Lagos-born artist in New York City who, just as Bob was saying a moment ago, uses his body as canvas and mixes up periods of dress as his paint, and then does self-portraits. And he has about a zillion theories about fashion, all of them incredibly carefully considered. This is not a person who listens to the radio or watches TV. This is a person whose expression is sartorial, almost completely his voice. So I hope that Bob will look forward to that piece as we are.
Here's this from Jesmond, who writes, I've kind of suffered a dislike for fashion, which to me often has much to do with costuming, where we dress up to inhabit a role that likely bears little resemblance to our actual authentic selves. I'm thinking of stuff like the growing popularity among white-collar workers of heavy-duty blue-collar brands like Carhartt and the recent lumber sexual style, which I find just insulting. Jackie Leiden, what do you think about that, this idea that the costume doesn't fit who we really are? I mean, it seems like we do that a lot.
Well, I think I'm going to push back on that. Then you maybe need to change the costume to have it be more authentic to you, because no one should wear anything that makes them feel hideously inauthentic. I mean, it's one reason, frankly, that I never went into broadcast news, television broadcast news, I hasten to add, because I felt like I could not dress in the unique and eccentric way that I needed to dress, and that just wasn't going to be me. It's better now for all kinds of women and men. There's more elasticity, but I'm talking 20 years ago. Getting back to Carhartt, I adore Carhartt, and I think that the whole industrial wear to day wear is something that we want to take a look at, when that became significant, why that became significant, what people are saying when they put on a legacy brand. Hamilton Carhartt started the Carhartt Company in 1878. He was a railroad engineer coming out of New York State. His motto was I'm going to make an honest outfit for an honest man, honest clothes for an honest man. I'm paraphrasing slightly. And he did, added a T to the end of his name, and off he went. Today, we see all kinds of people adopting that look, including people who don't go near a blue-collar life as they put on their Carhartt shoes for, you know, their hedge fund job, or job being an orderly in the hospital. So how we borrow from each other, I would say to Jesmyn, the writer, how we borrow what you're putting on, if it doesn't feel good, obviously it isn't quite right. But that doesn't mean it isn't authentic for the person who has chosen to put it on. And then I would say, and so why does that, you know, evoke such a strong reaction in a person looking?
Simon, what do you think?
I would encourage the writer of that comment to sort of enjoy the Mardi Gras of style as it comes by. You know, I think that people have always been I think it is inauthentic, but I think that's kind of great and sort of fun. And why not? You know, like, it's fun to dress up in a way that, you know, I used to love glam rock clothes, and I would wear all these satin outfits and go to Bowie concerts and things. But I don't think I was really that person. Ditto punk, you know, I look quite menacing in my punk outfits, some of which were in the punk show at the Met. But I really wasn't that person. And I think it's fun to sort of play roles. Women do it a lot. You know, Versace took street style. He looked at what the gorgeous hookers were wearing and repackaged it into a luxury product, and women embraced it because it was fun to feel. So I don't know. I think he's 100% right. It is inauthentic, but I would encourage him to sort of think that's kind of amusing and fun to think that there are hedge fund people who are dressing like artisanal, you know, pickle makers out in Brooklyn. It's very entertaining. It's part of that sort of landscape of, it's visually entertaining, but I could see how it might be a bit irritating to somebody. But I would say,
go with
you know, save the irritate, go with it, because it's not going to end. People are always going to do that.
Yeah,
like girls dressed up as Frida Kahlo. They're not Frida Kahlo. You know?
right. Well, it does raise the question that you see a lot. I mean, I always turn to Bill Cunningham's photographs in the New York Times on Sunday, where he really takes note of fashion, but also street style. I mean, I think you're seeing a lot of that these days. And I'm wondering from both of you, I guess, Jackie, I'll start with you. Do you get a sense that fashion is influenced from the street, or does it trickle down into the street? Or I suppose you might see it as going both ways?
I think it does go both ways. And here I feel more of a neophyte on this than someone who's worked in the industry for decades. But I certainly have been, as a journalist, looking at people for decades. And I think that we have seen a general influence of the street that's very au courant for today. We don't even think about it. I mean, the relaxation of waistlines, and by that I mean dropping them down, not so much expanding them out, dropping them down, or baseball caps turned backward, or things like this, unlaced shoes. Those are things that we see entering, you know, mainstream wear today. And I think that the big designers are always looking for influences all over the world. I remember how struck I was and how much I wanted to do something like the seams the second I read that Alexander McQueen's atelier got subscriptions to National Geographic. I mean, that magazine's been a passport for me since I could open one. And I thought, wow, okay, so there is some language here that's universal, you know, that goes on.
Simon, what do you think? Does fashion trickle down, or does it move in the other direction? I guess you see it as vast again. It must go both ways for you.
Yeah, absolutely goes both ways. And some things are more influential than others. You know, like I mentioned punk before. I mean, still to this day, when people wear black, it has this sort of sinister connotation. It's, you know, it's a tough, edgy look. And then you have hip hop, which is like an incredibly pervasive influence that, and these things don't necessarily go away. They just sort of enter the vast landscape and continue to influence. And so they might not be as specific today, because in the past we had these specific trends, like in the 60s we had mod, and then we went hippie, And then we went glam rock. And then there was sort of a vintagey era before it went disco and then punk and blah, blah, blah. We don't really have those so much now. It's more organic, but it's going on all the time and it is going in both directions. And as a consumer, you get to pick who you want to be. That's why that last caller was very interesting idea, that that whole thing of questioning authenticity, because you really can play games with your identity, especially if you're young. Why not?
Can I just throw out an anecdote? I don't know why this is imprinting on my brain so much right now, but I can recall my stepfather, who was a complicated and troubled human being, just before he left the family unit, striding into the kitchen and saying to my mother, "How do you like my jumpsuit?" This was one of the oddest fashions for men. It came from flight pilots, I think, you know, from outer space. And he had on this brown, you know, jumpsuit and a one-piece sort of garment, or it looked one piece. And I'll never forget my mother's answer: "Where were you planning to jump to?" So, it's just so fashion borrows from everything.
Yeah.
And jumpsuits are back for men. There's a lot of them this season.
Of course they are.
And I'm hugely jealous, as a short person, you can't really, you know, unless you have it custom made, the crotch is down to your knees, you know, it doesn't work. So
I don't think I'll be getting my husband in one either. He won't be giving up his tweed vests.
Oh, he should give it a whirl. What does he do for a living?
He is a photographer for the Washington Post.
Jumpsuit. He can totally do it.
I'll tell him you said so.
I mean, there's only a very few professions, I think, where you have to worry about jeopardizing your credibility. I think medical, like nobody wants a colonoscopy done by somebody in an ill-fitting jumpsuit.
What's that smock thing that Bill Cunningham, speaking of Bill Cunningham, what does he wear? Isn't it like this French smock?
Oh, I know about it because of the movie.
He buys them. Mm-hmm. He buys, yeah, me too. I always was aware of him in this blue jacket. And then he goes to that store in Paris, and it's some kind of uniform jacket that he buys from the same shop. He'll go crazy if they stop making it, but he's still able to buy, replenish them.
Yeah, exactly. That's what was so cool about it. It was just the most utilitarian garment imaginable.
Here's a comment from Linda, who writes, "My mother used to tell me that being a woman meant accepting pain as part of life. I heard a young 20-something saying last week, fashion isn't practical, it's pain. Her question is, does it need to be? I've long given up the painful parts of dressing, like high heels. Sometimes when I'm trying to look nice, though, I feel I'm missing the mark for being, quote-unquote, comfortable."
Oh, I wish I could go to Linda's house and play with her garments and attire, and I bet I know we'd have a good time because she's listening to this and caring. I think that the whole notion of pain and whether a woman should accept that is a different, huge question. And my answer to it would be no. What is it telling you? We all get messages. I certainly got some. I told you it's one of the good ones from my mother, but there were others, I think, that were less salubrious and good for me. And I don't think that anyone is going to be happy if they're in pain wearing a piece of jewelry or whatever it would be, especially if you're going to go on with that all day. Lots of people are willing to maybe have a high heel that isn't the greatest for their feet for a certain amount of hours. But that's a choice. And I think there's so much range out there now that you need not do that. And I think you really can be both comfortable and look splendid. I really do.
Here's a question from Cardi, who writes, "I'm wondering..." But Cardi, by the way, has a clothing line called Hellbent Clothing.
Oh, I love the title.
Right? Put in a plug there. She writes, or he writes, Cardi writes, "I'm wondering why it is you think that people tend to tone down their crazy sides of style as they get older. Why do people become more mundane, less daring, and really just boring as they get older?"
Oh, Simon? This is my favorite subject. I'm very much against that idea of growing old graciously, of dressing age appropriately. And I'm approaching mid-60s, so but I continue to dress with fearless flamboyance and encourage others to do so. And I actually wrote an article for AARP magazine on this very subject because I felt so passionately about it, because I think, you know, you've earned your stripes. As you get older, you should feel a reckless freedom to wear whatever you want. And I don't understand this idea of, you know, I think that period where older people were supposed to represent these values of being reserved and being very composed and being very, sort of representing all these serious things to younger people. I think that ship has sailed. I think now when you're old, you can just do whatever you want and have fun with it. And go for it. Don't be intimidated by those ideas. Like, why are you know, the older you get, you're approaching death. Why not just go out with a bang, you know, like Phyllis Diller?
Especially if you're manufacturing Heaven Sent, or is it Hellbent clothes?
Hellbent, yeah. And Cardi, by the way, is a woman, mother of two, as a matter of fact.
All right.
Here's a tweet from Whitney who wants to know, do you think today's fashion is derivative, or are designers still innovating?
Well, I think that fashion, I think a designer is under a lot of pressure at the very top of the pyramid. We did a piece a couple weeks ago with the great fashion writer Dana Thomas, who is a contributing editor from Paris for T Magazine, and she talked about the pressures at the top of the heap with all the seasons that designers have to come up with. So there is a lot of pressure, and sometimes I'm thinking things could probably look like they did a few seasons back. But I also think that any artist wants to innovate, and that people do, and certainly that would be what their attempts would be.
What do you think, Simon, about that? I mean, there is some question about whether we got stuck somewhere in the mid 2000s, and we haven't budged that much.
I think that the answers are basically yes, it's derivative, and yes, people continue to innovate, because it's very hard to, you know, as I keep saying, it's such a vast landscape of conflicting ideas and variety. There are people on there who are clearly marking out new territory for themselves, you know, like Rick Owens, for example, is this very sort of goth, creative, austere. His vision is sort of, it's hard to find antecedents for it. Most stuff, you know, the designer themselves may think they're doing something new, but you can always do like Meryl Streep did in The Devil Wears Prada and track a color or a style back, you know, find some precedent for it. But I think they're a very innovative. That's the magic of today. There's a wonderful book called The Fashionable Selby. And I would encourage everyone who's interested in fashion to get this book, The Fashionable Selby. Todd Selby has a website. And you'll see this collection of really interesting people who are innovative. They're not, some of them aren't global names, but yeah, there's a tremendous amount of variety. And people can get the impression, though, today there isn't that, there aren't the innovators. But the reality is it was a smaller landscape back in the day, so it was easier to spot the Gautiers and the Romeo Gilles and the Yoji Yamamotos, because it was a smaller landscape. Those people are all out there, the new versions of them. You just have to rummage, because it's just such a vast landscape, from H&M to the Paris Couture. It's like a huge smorgasbord. Have fun with it.
That's Simon Doonan. His latest book is The Asylum, True Tales of Madness from a Life in Fashion. And Jackie Leiden is a longtime correspondent for NPR and founder of The Seams. It's a series on NPR and an independent podcast that looks at fashion. We have links to all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about fashion with Jackie Leiden and Simon Doonan. Christy sends this from Facebook. She says, I change my clothes about 6 times before I walk out the door each morning. So why did I choose to wear what I'm wearing today? Largely because it was the least objectionable thing I tried on today. Here's something from another Christy who writes, my fashion choices boil down to which sweater, which jeans in winter, which T-shirt, which jeans in summer. Ben writes, fashion works. It works between the bookends of the family budget and extends from there. As children of a single mom, my brother and I had 2 pairs of pants, 3 shirts, 1 long sleeve, 2 T-shirts, each with Kmart suits for church and overalls for outside play. That was it. Overalls accepted. It's no exaggeration to say that my wardrobe has changed a little since then. Here's a tweet from Andrea who writes, growing up Mormon, I felt the modesty talk treated fashion as evil. Embracing fashion now is one way I distance myself from my past. Jackie, what do you think about that? That idea that, you know, the Andrea grows up with a certain kind of worldview perspective, and fashion is a way of saying, I'm going to try a new direction.
I think it's a truism, and I feel that she's saying something bold. But I actually liked all those comments because everyone was thinking about what their clothes and what they were saying. Andrea's comment, though, is probably in many ways parallel to my own in the sense that we certainly didn't have any money. My mother was effectively a single mom, divorced when I was 6. And as I said at the outset of the program, the idea that you're inventing your life as you go along and that you're doing it through your clothes and the possibilities being endless, not expensive, endless, I just find that very liberating, and it sounds like she did too.
Yeah. I wonder if there seems to be this trend. Simon mentioned H&M and Uniqlo, for example. There are a number of these kind of fast fashion outfits out there. And I'm wondering if you're starting to see a reaction to that. I mean, you're seeing a lot of artisanal, you know, raw denim, people making raw denim, making leatherware, making, you know, all kinds of mm-hmm. different stuff. Are you seeing that as a reaction to that?
I think so, and I'd really be curious to see what Simon has to say about this, because it seems to me that we want more provenance on a lot of things. You know, all kind of cheese to wine, correct? I mean, shoes to hair products. When I go to a green market, any kind of market, people will say the eggs are from here. I made this hand lotion myself in the bathroom,
right.
And I don't think it's a lot different. We're going to have fast fashion. It can be almost a whole other topic. And I think it's trying to reconcile itself with some of the upsides and downsides of that particular market. But I'm going to leave that aside at the moment and talk locally, which allows for companies like the person who called in from Hellbent Clothes to get in there and give us something that maybe it does look just like Utah. Maybe it is channeling a picture that's historic and specific to that state. Maybe it is a kind of wool that is grown on a sheep that lives 3 counties over from you. Maybe you made part of it yourself. Maybe the appliqué comes from a tunic your grandmother wore and you just put it on vintage Lanvin. You know, so I think that people are sending it up, beginning to want that kind of authenticity, and by provenance, I mean where it comes from, that we want in a lot of things now.
Simon, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's true. You hear an increasing interest in the craft of how things are made. The idea that they might be made by hand is appealing to people. In many cases, that translates into a much higher price tag, but not always. You know, you could go to the green market and get some face cream that somebody pulverized themselves and wouldn't be too expensive. But, you know, artisanal usually does add on the buck. So it's sort of important to be upfront about that.
Not always. The question comes up from time to time, what's happened to this trend? And maybe some needed explained to them. Normcore.
Yes. I've written a lot about that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fantastic trend for regular blokes because the idea of normcore is this sort of stripped down, super anonymous, logo-free, generic-looking, sort of preppy, but not always, way of dressing, which is sort of bland anonymity run amok. Mm. And it's very appealing to younger kids. You see a lot of guys, these hipsters, you know, will wear it with a logo-free. You can't tell what they're wearing, but they each know what the other one's wearing. It's immensely codified and obsessive. It's not my personal go-to because I'm very more theatrical. But I think in terms of looking pulled together and great, it has enormous appeal because it's very low risk because you don't look flashy or parvenu. You look sort of anonymous, and the rewards come from being recognized, you know, by other people who are purveying that look. And it has, as a result, become very ubiquitous. You can walk into J. Crew or Brooks Brothers or Barney's or anywhere, and you can pick out the sort of normcore kind of things, like the little anorak, the windbreaker that has nothing on it right. And couldn't be simpler. I mean, I find it hilarious that people go to such lengths to be stylish. You know, there's an intrinsic paradox to it. It's very, again, very amusing. Yeah. But luckily, there are also other people who are wearing like the new Givenchy T-shirt with a Rottweiler on the front. So there's, thank God, everybody isn't walking around looking unbelievably anonymous.
Simon Doonan, he's a creative ambassador for the department store chain Barney's New York, and his latest book is The Asylum: True Tales of Madness from a Life in Fashion. Jackie Lydon is the creator of the NPR series and podcast, The Seams. We have links to all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. And you can go to Video West for a new video in our series called Street Style, where we investigate style in Utah. Our latest video was shot at Library Square in downtown Salt Lake City. Go to videowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.